This is episode 1-5 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Welcome to the Software Freedom Law Show. We have for you today another interview show.
Yes, it's another interview. And we have to do our thing, or your thing, really, which is prepare to say what the guest is, but not really
it's
say what
the thing, guest is. My thing, except you've inflated it so much, I feel like it's your thing now.
No, my thing is the meta discussion about it being your thing.
Oh, I see. Well, we've accomplished both, I think.
So we'll do the thing, which is to say it's a guest from an organization that is sponsors and takes care of and oversees a programming language project, a project implementing and making more popular. That sounds a little strange, but making available to the world information about a programming language.
Yeah, and I guess that helps to run a free software nonprofit.
Yes, the free software nonprofit, in fact, that makes the language more popular or helps make the language more popular and helps run conferences about it and all that sort of thing.
You know, it's sort of off. Okay, it's totally off topic, but
no, it's not. I don't think so.
You don't know what I'm about to say.
Oh, that's right. I don't know what you're about to say. Let's see if it's off topic. Go ahead and say it, and we'll see.
I was going to say this reminds me of when I just graduated from engineering school. I had, I did all these law firm interviews, and in the language section where everything.
So wait, you do the law firm?
It's like your first year or something. Yeah, so you do the first year, but I still felt pretty fresh out of engineering school because law school was like an alien place after engineering school.
Right, but we should make the timeline clear because actually this is interesting. I think it might be a little interesting for our listeners how the process goes. So you went undergrad to get an engineering degree.
Yes.
And then law school is a three-year process, which...
Yes, and in the United States, you can study, you need an undergrad degree before... Well, for most people get an undergrad degree before going to law school, so it's usually a four-year undergraduate degree and then a three-year law degree. Was that what you were going to...
Yeah, that's I think, a lot of people... I didn't know, in fact, that law school was 3 years until I was in my 20s at some point, because I didn't go and I never asked.
And business school is 2 years, which also lends some confusion, because sometimes people think law school is... that law school is shorter than it is.
And PhD in computer science
is much longer.
20 years, whatever. You just stay until they stop funding you and then...
And the timeline that Bradley was talking about is the curious law student timeline within law school, which is that you have your first year usually taking core classes like constitutional law and contracts and property. You have sort of the first year foundation, but before you sort of... Before you start your second year, actually, you generally interview for jobs for your next summer. So for the summer between your second, year and your third year of law school. But that job, if you follow the whole law firm path, is the job that you have when you graduate law school. So you're basically interviewing for your job that you're going to have most likely after law school when you've only barely finished 1 year of law school. It's really kind of weird. You've got 2 years left to go. Now, it's not, a lot of people work at jobs after the first summer and they don't go there after they finish law school. Anyway, that's quite boring, and we prefer people who pursue a more alternative path and go straight to nonprofits. But
to analogize that process to what technical people might go through, imagine if in your second year of college you internship somewhere, but almost always you went from interningship there at the end of your sophomore year to working there at the very end when you graduated. So that's sort of the similar process.
It's very early on. I sort of felt like a fish out of water in law school anyway at this point, having come from engineering school, and the interviews were quite odd as well. And you go and you interview, at the law school I went to, they have this interview process, and you put on your resume, and I've made this story so long now, but on your resume you have a languages section, and in the law world that generally means, you say I speak conversational German or whatever, but when I graduated I wrote rudimentary knowledge of one language, which I'm not revealing because I don't speak it very well.
Natural language, you mean?
One natural language, and then I put out the computer languages that I was familiar, that I programmed in, and it caused quite a stir at interviews. It was always hilarious, but of course now that's not unusual at all. I'd imagine.
Really, you think that there are a lot of people who go to work in the legal world who have experience programming? Really?
I think there are more now than there were then.
That I probably agree with. But
I think that people who are not familiar with technology as much, or computers, are now much more familiar with the idea of a computer language and what that means than they were. I won't reveal how long ago it was that I went to law school.
Well, what I am going to try to make you reveal is, mm-hmm. you wouldn't reveal which natural language you put on there, but will you reveal what programming language you
put? Oh, well, I've mentioned this before. I put C and Fortran and Lisp.
C and Fortran. Well, Lisp. That's Lisp. At least a little respectable. I mean, if you had Scheme, that would have actually been truly respectable. Lisp, you know, not bad. But dynamic scoping, I mean, come on.
Yeah, since I went to engineering school, the languages.
Yeah, well, that explains the Fortran. Okay, that explains
and the C.
Fortran. Well, C, everybody's supposed to know.
And
C,
I started using and Lisp as well, actually.
Oh, it's because of AutoCAD.
Yeah, well, that's how I got started, and then there was an AI lab.
So, is the Lisp engine and AutoCAD dynamically scoped as well? I assume it must be.
You know, I don't know.
You don't know.
I'm
going to quiz you now on the difference between dynamic and lexical scoping.
I think this is a great time to go to our next segment.
Indeed, and we're going to talk to someone from an organization that supports, a nonprofit organization that supports a programming language that is none of these and a much better than all these three, I think. So, Karen, continuing with our series of talking to the leadership of various nonprofit organizations related to open source and free software, today we have Steve Holden from the Python Software Foundation.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bradley. Karen, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. We've been really sort of researching high and low to understand how the different nonprofits in the free software and open source space work. So we'd really like to hear from you about what's unique about the Python Software Foundation among these various nonprofits.
Can we start out by asking Steve about how he got involved with Python and the Python Software Foundation?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Well, I got involved with Python pretty much by accident, really. My object-oriented history goes back a long time. I was a follower of Alan Kay, the original inventor of Smalltalk, back in the 1970s. And even did an implementation of Smalltalk when I was an academic, or at least had a research student do one for me. But I never really got on that well with Smalltalk. I didn't feel it was a natural language. So one day, my wife and I had a pager, and we were waiting for a restaurant table. And I went upstairs to a bookstore in the same mall and came across the Learning Python book in the O'Reilly series, picked it up, realized that it actually represented what I thought was a very sensible approach to object-oriented programming. And so I started using Python. That would be probably 1996, 97, something like that. Python was at 1.5 at the time. And never really looked back. So I've been a Python user for quite a long time now.
So how did you get involved in the nonprofit itself and eventually could become president?
Well, I got involved with the foundation because originally when I became a Python user, the Python conferences that were run, called the International Python Conferences, they were run by a commercial enterprise, and so they were the usual commercial cost structure. So somebody who was going to them could basically count on spending about $3,000 total to get through the conference package. I went to one of these in, I think it was probably 2001, 2002, and I thought, well, from my knowledge of the news group, there must be a lot of people who are using and contributing to Python who can't really afford these conferences. So I made the suggestion to Guido Van Rossum on a newly started conferences mailing list that maybe we should think about the community itself organizing the conference. Well, of course, you make a suggestion like that in the open source world, and that's tantamount to volunteering. So Guido agreed to try it as long as I would chair the conference, which I agreed to do. So I ran the first PyCon conference in Washington, D.C. in 2003, and after that conference, Guido proposed me for membership of the recently formed Python Software Foundation. So I think the next year I stood for the board. And then the way that it works in the Python Software Foundation is that the members elect the board and the board elects the chairman. So I think the first year I joined the board, Stefan Diebel was elected chairman. He was also a new member of the board. He gave up last year. And basically, when I said, well, who's going to be chairman, everybody else just stepped back. And that's how I got to be chairman.
So in very open source and free software way, you ended up consistently volunteering for things and being given more and more responsibility every time you volunteered for something new.
That's kind of the way that it worked, yes. I mean, I do have a lot of experience with user groups from way back, back in the UK, which is where I originate from, as you can probably tell by my accent. I was for 3 years the chairman of the Sun UK user group. And I was treasurer of DECUS, the old Digital Equipment Users Society, for 3 or 4 years as well. So I have had involvement with user groups before, but nothing quite like Python and the open source world, although I have been an open source or rather free software supporter for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Had you run a conference before that first PyCon?
Nope. I had run user meetings and that kind of thing, but basically I felt that the way to do it was to kind of wing the first one and just see what people wanted to do and act as an enabler, if we could, really, just an environment and find out what was popular and what wasn't. And just having an environment where people could sprint together, could work on software together, where there was a quiet room where people could go and having the talks. People just took to it quite naturally, and we relied a lot on volunteer effort. I mean, I didn't do all of the work myself by any manner or means. People just rolled the sleeves up and got on with it and really did kind of take ownership of the conference.
That's great. I mean, I know that PyCon is one of the major things that the foundation does. Is that sort of one of the primary activities?
Yes, I suppose it's the primary activity from in terms of revenue. Nowadays, PyCon, I think our revenues tend to be of the order of $600,000. So it is a major financial activity as far as the foundation is concerned. And it's the major visible portion of what the foundation does. But we do other things as well, and we use the funds that come in, among other things, to fund smaller conferences. So there are PyCons in Argentina, Brazil, Italy, Poland, the UK, France, all over the world now. And we do like to try and offer them as much help as we can to get off the ground, although I think ultimately the goal is that each conference should stand on its own. But I know that when I was starting PyCon, I was very nervous about using this little baby foundation's funds, mm-hmm. and what would happen if we made a financial loss. So it's nice to be able to remove that worry from the organizers of other conferences that are just starting up.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to run these conferences, and you know, it's probably a great help to have that financial stress relieved somewhat. Is the foundation mostly run by volunteers?
Yes, we have recently taken on an events organizer and a part-time administrator, but the board is all volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it's the usual thing, basically. People volunteer to join the board and then slowly get roped into one thing and another.
And when you were talking about Guido first electing you to membership, is that still how the process works? Do existing members elect new members out of the Python community? And how big is that membership?
That's right. The membership's currently, I think, 112 at the last count. We elected quite a few new members this year. The annual members meeting is at PyCon, which is usually in the February-March timeframe. So, yes, members have to be nominated by an existing member, and then they have to be approved by a simple majority of the members on a member's vote. So it's a bit like a gentleman's club, really, except there's no blackballing. You know, one member can't say, well, that person shouldn't join.
So what's your incorporation status as far as the U.S.? I assume you're a U.S. corporation?
We are a U.S. corporation registered in Delaware, and we're a registered 501c3. So we've gone through the whole rigmarole of becoming a registered charity. And I've recently been looking at something called fiscal sponsorship, which is a mechanism whereby a registered 501c3 can, to an extent, lend its charitable status to other organizations if they're running events and activities which help to contribute to the foundation's goals. So the intention is if we can make that scheme work, that the organizations who are running the smaller local conferences, because we're also now seeing the emergence of regional conferences like PyOhio and PyArkansas, and so the idea is that they won't need to register themselves as charitable foundations, which is, as you probably realize, quite a lot of work. Mm-hmm. They'll just be able to effectively say, well, we are working with Python Software Foundation. And nevertheless, the contributions ought to be tax deductible if we can make sure that the financial structures are properly organized.
Just to interject for our listeners here, actually, this is something we've been talking about, but sometimes we don't use we often use the word fiscal sponsorship, but sometimes we talk about umbrella organizations or a conservancy model. It's sort of all talking
yep.
about different sides of the same thing.
Well, I think we are, yes. A lot depends on the individual organizations, but really it's all about the language I've been using there is basically the language which the books I've read suggest that would be most acceptable to the Internal Revenue, because ultimately the thing that nobody wants is to challenge their own charitable status by undertaking activities which would put them into problems with the revenue.
That's yeah, right.
But yes, I think effectively, for example, the Software Freedom mm-hmm. Conservancy, mm-hmm. offer similar roles, although I'm not exactly sure that the relationship is one of fiscal sponsorship.
Karen and I are both volunteers for the Software Freedom Conservancy, and we actually, one of the reasons, although the IRS is comfortable with that phrase, fiscal sponsorship, generally speaking, we avoid it because the projects that join Conservancy have to do their own fundraising. So while we're accepting the donations on their behalf, we're not out there basically sponsoring them. So some people outside the nonprofits world, they get confused by that term, because when you say you're going to be a fiscal sponsor, they say, oh, you're going to give me money. Which, in fact, we're just going to make the infrastructure possible for you to raise said money. We're not actually going to give it to you.
Right. Well, the reason that we talk about fiscal sponsorship is that we would only consider sponsoring projects which contribute to the goals of the Python Software Foundation, whereas you're more of an umbrella organization because the projects that you're dealing with are somewhat more diverse in their aim.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where different terminology comes in handy is because there are so many different ways of doing fiscal sponsorship. If you've read the book, I forget how many ways he has of doing it right, but there's
if we've read the same book, he's talking about six mechanisms,
yes,
I think.
Yes, sure. And sort of the ways that you think about fiscal sponsorship are, and there are a couple of other books as well that are useful, but whether or not the project becomes an actual part of the legal entity, whether they become a part of the umbrella or whether it's sort of a separate grant funding relationship, the ways in which the relationship is established between the entity and the project, it's helpful to have different terms that have different shades of meaning, even though we're sort of talking about the same general class.
Sure, yes, of course, ultimately all we're talking about really is treading a fine enough line that nobody gets in trouble with the legal authorities and the Internal Revenue, which ultimately mm-hmm. is a set of issues I'd rather not deal with,
sure.
But it's the old saying, it's a dirty, rotten job and someone's got to do it.
Yeah, and the best part is the more projects that we consolidate under these umbrellas or fiscal sponsorships, it means that there are more resources and it's easier to get it right.
Well, I think the Software Freedom Conservancy does a great job. I know that among the other projects that you support, there's, I think, Inkscape and the Twisted Software Foundation, which is mm-hmm. part of the Python world. And I do know that without your support, the Twisted guys would probably never have got it together to be able to solicit donations. And they've actually been using the donations they've solicited directly in support of developments of the software that they work with. So I think you do a terrific job, and more strength to your arm.
Yeah, thanks. That's definitely great to hear. But before we turn it too much into a mutual appreciation society, I wanted to, because I'm, of course, a fan of the Python Software Foundation as well and the work that you do, I want for our listeners to get to another topic that's of interest to because we talk about a lot of legal issues on this show. Can you talk a little bit about Python's license? And I know that you guys maintain, for example, the Python trademark. So I'd like to hear both about the copyright license side that you guys do and the trademark side.
Yeah, okay, fine. Well, the license is a fairly open license. It's not quite as open as BSD, which basically says you can do, in my own paraphrase of the BSD license, is you can do pretty much whatever you want with the software as long as you say it's licensed under the BSD license. The Python software license is similarly liberal. There's no restriction on use. There's no requirement for people who make use of the Python code base to contribute it back, such as the requirements of the GPL, for example. And that's broadly in line with Guido van Rossum's original determination of how he wanted his intellectual property to be used. So I don't think that the essential conditions of the license have changed since it was first introduced. There were a couple of hiccups at one stage due to rapid change in the employment status of some of the principal developers. And so we've got what's called the Python license stack, because we've licensed, I think, 2.4 was up, everything up to 2.4 was licensed under one license. And then we've had to incorporate that license into the 2.5 and onwards license. Oh, so no, it's actually 2.0, I think. But anyway, at some stage, when the licensing changed, we had to realize that existing code had been accepted under old licenses. So we are working to try to simplify that, to make it easier for people to understand the implications of adopting the Python license. But I'm happy to say that there's never been any need to pursue anyone legally for license violations.
Now,
in terms of... Oh, sorry, Karen.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to ask you if does the foundation hold the copyrights, or are those each held by contributors?
Each contributor provides us with a license to re-license the material, so they retain the copyright of their contributions, but they grant us a license. And in fact, we're prepared to accept two different incoming licenses. They can license material to us either under the Apache license or under the General Academic license? I can't remember the exact license, but there are two different ways that people can license the material to us. All we're really interested in is having an unencumbered ability to pass the materials on under the Python Software Foundation's own license. Mm-hmm. So as far as we're concerned, they retain the rights to their contributions, and if they want to relicense them to other people in other ways, they're quite at liberty to do so.
And so did they actually sign a contributor licensing agreement or something like that when they contribute to the main Python core?
Yep, there is a formal contributor agreement which includes the transfer of licensability to us, the licensing of the property to us. And we're trying to get everybody to sort that out. In fact, I think at the moment there's a certain small percentage of the code base which isn't covered by contributor licenses, but we have a couple of directors going around with a big stick chasing people to sign licensing contributor agreements at the moment. So the more of the code that's covered, the better, obviously.
Now, so that sort of covers the copyright side, but you guys also do work with regard to the trademark on, the term Python as well?
The word Python is registered as a trademark in the United States, yes, and we're looking at registering it in a few other legislations, the more active ones. We also have a logo for Python, which the members have agreed at the last members' meeting we should protect as a registered trademark.
Yeah, I saw on you've got an interesting statement on your website about trademarks where you very concisely state the law, and that's actually kind of nice that, you know, you reiterate there's this thing called nominative use, which just allows factual use, and I think we've talked about that before. So that's, you know, I was just noticing that.
Yes, clearly we can't have the right to see, people have to be able to talk about the Python programming language, and so we do make it quite clear that when they're doing so, they don't have any real need to refer to the foundation. But if somebody wants to call a piece of software something Python or Python something, then we would at least like to be able to determine whether or not we're happy with that usage. Really, there was a long discussion about this among the members. That's gone on over the past 18 months, I would say. And the conclusion that we came to generally was that we want to be as liberal as we can with people who are undertaking activities that are supportive of Python, like running Python user groups, writing books about Python, and so on. So we actually now have a trademarks committee which has 5 or 6 members on it. And whenever somebody sends a request in, we pass it to the trademarks committee, and they decide whether or not they think it's an acceptable use of the logo or the trademark. As far as the statement of statement of trademark usage goes, we have Stefan Diebel to thank for that, because he went to the trouble of looking up the law and trying to summarize it in that statement that you saw on the foundation's website.
So as a bit of edification for our listeners, can you talk a little bit about what the scope of the Python trademark is? Because obviously it doesn't cover uses when people actually sell literal snakes at a pet store.
No,
indeed. So can you talk a little bit about what scope you guys got the trademark in?
Yeah, when you register a trademark, it has to be registered with a specific scope. And the scope that we've registered the word Python with is for use in description of programming languages. So nobody can write another programming language called Python without our say-so. Not that I think anyone would try to, but you never know. There are a couple of shady characters out there who are playing games with the Python name, and we've actually had to send one person a cease and desist letter for particular uses of the word Python. But nothing that I'd want to dignify with publicity.
Yeah, indeed. And, of course, all the pet stores are safe because they can sell their pythons.
The pet stores are indeed safe, yes. Although if they want to use the logo, we might have to talk about royalties.
So can you tell us, the Python communities are really... I recently personally got involved with Python. I had been a Perl guy for a long time, but I started working on the weekends on a project that actually was written in Python and uses Twisted, which we mentioned earlier. So I've been looking more into the Python community and trying to get involved a little bit with it just to see what it's like. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the things that are going on in the community lately? I know PyCon's coming up, but what else is going on other than the PyCon conference next year?
Let me see. Well, not a huge amount at the moment, if I can think about it. I mean, there's lots happening on the international scene. In fact, this morning I got an invitation to the very first PyCon Asia Pacific conference in Singapore next June. So the global growth of the language is certainly going on apace. In terms of projects, we've been fairly quiet lately. One of the more interesting things that happened at this year's PyCon in March was that we finally got our audio-visual story together. We've been trying to do good recordings of PyCon for years and years, and usually failing and with various degrees of misery. But I'm happy to say that this year, the whole thing came together beautifully under a team managed by a guy called Carl Karsten. And we were actually pretty much editing video live so that by the time the conference was over, the first sessions had already appeared. So if people want to see what PyCon is like, they can go to pycon.blip.tv, and there are lots and lots of talks already available there. In fact, I think pretty much the whole of this year's PyCon is now available on video. So that was an exciting development. Something that's happened more recently is that we've put out a questionnaire. I don't know whether you've seen any of the emails relating to it. Basically, to try and find out who is using Python. And the purpose behind that is, I shouldn't use this term because I know it upsets some people in the open source world, but it's really a marketing exercise. Effectively, what we need to know is we need to know who's using Python and what for, so that we can be sure that the activities of the foundation are relevant. And so also we can tap these people and ask them for support for the foundation. So that's been an amazing response. I was looking at the spreadsheet, which is formulated by people filling out a Google form this week. And in less than a week, we've had over 450 replies from people and organizations who want to tell us how they use Python. And surprisingly, in probably half of the cases, Python is actually essential to the operation. They regard Python as essential to the operation of their organization, which is quite stunning. So after we've finished this conference call, I actually have another conference call with a few people to decide what we're going to do with this information and how we can get back to these people and offer them support and ask for their help.
Are you mostly collecting that information through email contact from lists that you already have? Or
We basically, various people have made blog entries. We sent a list out to the an email out to the members list. I think one went out to comp.lang.python, which is the general Python list. So yeah, it's been fairly well publicized on the mailing list and so on. And in fact, we've got two separate sets of responses: one from the membership, and then one from people who aren't members. And I'm delighted to say that the people who aren't members are by far the majority at the moment. So there seems to be a lot of interest in the foundation by people who haven't actively been knocking on our door, but they do nevertheless seem to want to get involved. And and they want the foundation to get involved with them, which is very good news.
Yeah, that's really excellent. I'm a big fan. Yeah, I used to be a Perl bigot, but I'm a big fan of basically any language now that's come out of a community development process. And I think Python is a great example of the type of technologies that come fully out of free software. Guido released the earliest versions as free software to the world, and that language has developed in that community process. So you know, with lots of arguments going on about other, you know, proprietary languages and technologies, I think you know, all these technologies and languages that came out of our community and were developed by our community are great. So I'm really appreciative of the work that you guys are doing at the Python Software Foundation specifically, and just in the Python community in general in that regard. And I want to thank you for spending the time to talk to us a little bit about how the organization works.
Well, that's a pleasure. I have to say, one of the joys of working with the Python community is that, by and large, we tend to be free of language bigotry, which I know does crop up in some other communities from time to time. So, for example, this year at PyCon, we were joined by Alison Randall, who's the head of the Perl Software Foundation, and who also chairs OSCON.
Mm-hmm.
And Alison was there primarily to talk about handing over the intellectual property in the Parrot software, which is an intimate part of Perl 6, to the Python Software Foundation's management. So we're quite prepared to work with other people in the Python community. We don't feel that Python should be the only true language or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the nice things, I just went to EuroPython in June in the United Kingdom, and Bruce Eckel was speaking there. And Bruce is apparently, as he told us then, a very uncomfortable traveler. So he didn't enjoy his trip over from the United States to the UK. But when he was giving his keynote, he said one of the nice things was that when he arrived at the conference, he looked around and he said, "Ah, Python people," and relaxed, because he knew that he was going to find a welcome and that people weren't going to be hostile to him. And as Python Software Foundation chairman, I'm trying to promote that kind of response to people as well. I think we want to be inclusive and not exclusive, and I think we want to be as helpful to everybody as we can, really.
That's great, and we really appreciate you coming and sharing that message on our podcast.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me, and if anybody wants to know more about the Python language, they should just go to python.org, start there, and take it from there.
Great, thanks again.
Good talking with you.
Bye.
So I saw that you got all excited when Steve was talking about Parrot.
Well, that's because he was mentioning specifically a project that is currently under the umbrella, more or less, of the Parrot Foundation, but might move to the Python Software Foundation. What it is an implementation of the Python language on the Parrot virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked about the Parrot virtual machine, I think, a few times before on the podcast, and it's a project that I'm personally interested in, you know, nights and weekends type time.
After nights and weekends spent on Conservancy.
true enough. But I usually get a couple hours a weekend, and about 5 or 6 weeks ago, I actually got commit access on the very project he was talking about, the Piney project, which is the Python implementation for Parrot. So I'm actually a committer and have contributed code to that project, and of course I'll have to sign the Python contributor licensing mm-hmm. agreement and so forth.
So you know all of this firsthand.
Well, not yet. I haven't looked at all the documents over yet at the time we're recording. Probably by the time people hear this, I will have. But that's why I was asking about the contributor license agreement, because I'm like, I'm going to have to sign this pretty soon, so I would like to know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So
we had a lull, and I just made a funny face, and it stopped our conversation. I figured our listeners
True enough.
Should,
and you're drinking that hot chocolate with so much hot chocolate in it. You just kept putting more and more in. And it's going to make sludge at the bottom.
I added unsweetened cocoa to a pre-sweetened packet.
Yeah, and then, but you're going to have all that sludge
at
the bottom.
And it will be delicious.
That sludge. You want sludge at the bottom of your hot chocolate.
I think we can do better for our listeners than to talk about my
hot chocolate. Look, the Linux Outlaws guys spend half the show talking about their beverages. So at the very end, I think we can say a few things about what beverages we're drinking. And I'm drinking coffee, of course.
Of course. Iced coffee.
Yeah, because it's summer.
And actually, I feel like we could do a whole podcast on the particularities of our coffee maker, and which we won't do. But
it's true enough.
But Bradley's iced coffee is made with coffee ice cubes. that he has made. There's serious attention paid to a quality cup of iced coffee, and every time he makes one, I want it.
Well, see, here's the thing about ice cubes. The thing about ice cubes is all they do is dilute your beverage. So I make coffee ice cubes so that the coffee is not diluted when the ice melts. It's very simple. It's physics, really. Chemistry, maybe.
All right. I mean, I'm willing to say to that.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're at the end of the show.
Enough, and thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.